dressed as a man, and so on. More fantastic still were the tales of his vizier, the famous Father Inir, who looked like a monkey and was the oldest man in the world. We had just begun trading wonders in good earnest, when there was a knock at the door. The youngest opened it, and I saw Rosh, dressed not in the Fulgen breeches and cloak the regulations of the guild decree, but in common, though new and fashionable, trousers, shirt, and coat. He motioned to me, and when I came to the door to speak with him, he indicated that I was to follow him. After we had gone some way down the stair, he said, "I'm afraid I frightened the little fellow. He doesn't know who I am." "Not in those clothes," I told him. "He'd recall you if he saw you dressed the way you used to be." That pleased him, and he laughed. "Do you know, it felt so strange having to bang on that door? Today is, what, the 18th? It's been under 3 weeks. How are things going for you?"
"Well enough.
You seem to have the gang in hand.
Ida's your second, isn't he?"
"He won't make a journeyman for 4 years, so he'll be captain for 3 after you. It's good for him to have the experience. And I'm sorry now you didn't have more before you had to take the job on. I stood in your way. But I never thought about it at the time."
"Rosh, where are we going?"
"Well, first we're going down to my cabin to get you dressed. Are you looking forward to becoming a journeyman yourself, Severian?" These last words were thrown over his shoulder as he clattered down the steps ahead of me, and he did not wait for an answer. My costume was much like his, though of different colors. There were overcoats and caps for us, too. "You'll be glad for them," he said as I put mine on. "It's cold out and starting to snow." He handed me a scarf and told me to take off my worn shoes and put on a pair of boots.
"They're journeyman's boots," I protested. "I can't wear those."
"Go ahead. Everyone wears black boots. Nobody will notice.
Do they fit?"
They were too large, so he made me draw a pair of his stockings on over my own. "Now, I'm supposed to keep the purse, but since there's always a chance we may be separated, it would be better if you have a few azimai." He dropped coins into my palm. "Ready? Let's go. I'd like to be back in time for some sleep if we can." We left the tower, and, muffled in our strange clothing, rounded the witch's keep to take the covered walk leading past the Martello to the court called Broken. Rosh had been right. It was starting to snow. Fluffy flakes as big as the end of my thumb, sifting so slowly through the air that it seemed they must have been falling for years. There was no wind, and we could hear the creaking our boots made in breaking through the familiar world's new thin disguise. "You're in luck," Rosh told me. "I don't know how you worked this, but thank you."
"Worked what?"
"A trip to the Echopraxia, and a woman for each of us." "I know you know. Master Gerlose told me he'd already notified you."
"I had forgotten, and anyway, I wasn't sure he meant it. Are we going to walk? It must be a long way."
"Not as long as you probably think, but I told you, we have funds. There will be fiacres at the Bitter Gate. There always are. People are continually coming and going, though you wouldn't think it back in our little corner." To make conversation, I told him what the Chatelaine Thecla had said, that many people in the House Absolute did not know we existed.
"That's so, I'm sure.
When you're brought up in the guild, it seems like the center of the world. But when you're a little older, this is what I've found myself, and I know I can rely on you not to tell tales. Something pops in your head, and you discover it isn't the linchpin of this universe after all. Only a well-paid, unpopular business you happen to have fallen into." As Rosh had predicted, there were coaches, 3 of them, waiting in the broken court.
One was an exultance, with blazonings painted on the doors and palfreniers in fanciful liveries. But the other two were fiacres, small and plain. The drivers in their low fur caps were bending over a fire they had kindled on the cobbles. Seen at a distance through the falling snow, it seemed no bigger than a spark. Rosh waved an arm and shouted, and the driver vaulted into the seat, cracked his whip, and came rattling to meet us. When we were inside, I asked Rosh if he knew who we were, and he said, "We're two Optimates who had business in the Citadel and are bound now for the Echopraxia and an evening of pleasure." That's all he knows and all he needs to know. I wondered if Rosh were much more experienced at such pleasures than I was myself. It seemed unlikely. In the hope of discovering whether he had visited our destination before, I asked where the Echopraxia lay. "In the Algedonic Quarter. Have you heard of it?" I nodded, and said that Master Palaemon had once mentioned that it was one of the oldest parts of the city. "Not really. There are parts farther south that are older still. A waste of stone where only Amophagists live." "The Citadel used to stand some distance north of Nessus. Did you know that?" I shook my head. "The city keeps creeping upriver. The Armigers and Optimates want purer water. Not that they drink it, but for their fish ponds, and for bathing and boating. Then, too, anyone living too near the sea is always somewhat suspect. So the lowest parts, where the water's the worst, are gradually given up. In the end, the law goes, and those who stay behind are afraid to kindle a fire, for fear of what the smoke may draw down on them." I was looking out the window. We had already passed through a gate unknown to me, dashing by helmeted guards. But we were still within the Citadel, descending a narrow close between two rows of shuttered windows. "When you are a journeyman, you can go into the city any time you want, provided you're not on duty." I knew that already, of course, but I asked Rosh if he found it pleasant. "Not pleasant exactly. I've only gone twice, to tell you the truth. Not pleasant, but interesting. They know who you are, naturally." "You said the driver didn't." "Well, he probably doesn't. Those drivers go all over Nessus. He may live anywhere and not get to the Citadel more than once a year. But the locals know. The soldiers tell. They always know. And they always tell. That's what everybody says. They can wear their uniforms when they go out." "These windows are all dark. I don't think there's anyone in this part of the Citadel at all. Everything's getting smaller. Not much anybody can do about that. Less food means fewer people. Until the new sun comes." Despite the cold, I had felt stifled in the fiacre. "Is it much farther?" I asked. Rosh chuckled. "You're bound to be nervous." "No, I'm not." "Certainly you are. Just don't let it bother you. It's natural. Don't be nervous about being nervous, if you see what I mean." "I'm quite calm." "It can be quick if that's what you want. You don't have to talk to the woman if you don't want to. She doesn't care. Of course, she'll talk if that's what you like. You're paying. In this case, I am, but the principle's the same. She'll do what you want within reason. If you strike her or use a grip, they'll charge more."
"Do people do that?"
"You know, amateurs. I didn't think you'd want to, and I don't think anybody in the guild does it, unless perhaps they're drunk." He paused.
"The women are breaking the law, so they can't complain."
With the fiacre sliding alarmingly, we wheeled out of the close and into a still narrower one that ran crookedly east. Chapter 9. The House Azure.
Our destination was one of those accretive structures seen in the older parts of the city. But so far as I know, only there, in which the accumulation and interconnection of what were originally separate buildings produce a confusion of jutting wings and architectural styles, with peaks and turrets where the first builders had intended nothing more than rooftops. The snow had fallen more heavily here, or perhaps had only been falling while we rode. It surrounded the high portico with shapeless mounds of white, softened and blurred the outlines of the entrance, made pillows of the window ledges, and masking and robing the wooden caryatids who supported the roof, seemed to promise silence, safety, and secrecy. There were dim yellow lights in the lower windows. The upper stories were dark. In spite of the drifted snow, someone within must have heard our feet outside. The door, large and old and no longer in the best condition, swung back before Rosh could knock. We entered and found ourselves in a narrow little room like a jewel box, in which the walls and ceiling were covered with blue satin quilting. The person who had admitted us wore thick-soled shoes and a yellow robe. His short white hair was smoothed back from a wide but rounded brow above a beardless and unlined face. As I passed him in the doorway, I discovered that I was looking into his eyes as I might have looked into a window. Those eyes could truly have been of glass, so unveined and polished they seemed like a sky of summer drought.
"You are in good fortune," he said, and handed us each a goblet. "There is no one here but yourselves."
Rosh answered, "I'm sure the girls are lonesome."
"They are. You smile. I see you do not believe me, but it is so. They complain when too many attend their court, but they are sad too when no one comes. Each will try to fascinate you tonight. You'll see. They'll want to boast when you are gone that you chose them. Besides, you are both handsome young men."
He paused, and though he did not stare, seemed to look at Rosh more closely.
"You have been here previously, have you not? I remember your red hair and high color. Far to the south in the narrow lands, the savages paint a fire spirit much like you. And your friend has the face of an exultant. That is what my young women like best of all. I see why you brought him here."
His voice might have been a man's tenor or a woman's contralto. Another door opened. It had a stained glass insert showing the temptation. We went into a room that seemed, no doubt in part, because of the constriction of the one we had just left, more spacious than the building could well contain. The high ceiling was festooned with what appeared to be white silk, giving it the air of a pavilion. Two walls were lined with colonnades. These were false, the pretended columns being only half-round pilasters, pressed against their blue-painted surfaces. And the architrave, no more than a molding. But so long as we remained near the center, the effect was impressive and nearly perfect. At the farther end of this chamber, opposite the windows, was a high-backed chair like a throne. Our host seated himself in it, and almost at once I heard a chime somewhere in the interior of the house. In two lesser chairs, Rosh and I waited in silence, while its clear echoes died. There was no sound from outside, yet I could sense the falling snow. My wine promised to hold the cold at bay, and in a few swallows I saw the bottom of the cup. It was as though I were awaiting the beginning of some ceremony in the ruined chapel. But at once, less real and more serious.
"The Chatelaine Barbia," our host announced.
A tall woman entered.
So poised was she, and so beautifully and daringly dressed, that it was several moments before I realized she could be no more than 17. Her face was oval and perfect, with limpid eyes, a small straight nose, and a tiny mouth painted to appear smaller still. Her hair was so near to burnished gold that it might have been a wig of golden wires. She posed herself a step or two before us, and slowly began to revolve, striking 100 graceful attitudes. At the time, I had never seen a professional dancer. Even now, I do not believe I have seen one so beautiful as she. I cannot convey what I felt then, watching her in that strange room. "All the beauties of the court are here for you," our host said. "Here in the house Azure, by night flown here from the walls of gold to find their dissipation in your pleasure." Half hypnotized as I was, I thought this fantastic assertion had been put forward seriously. I said, "Surely that's not true." "You came for pleasure, did you not? If a dream adds to your enjoyment, why dispute it?" All this time, the girl with the golden hair continued her slow, unaccompanied dance. Moment flowed into moment. "Do you like her?" our host asked. "Do you choose her?" I was about to say, to shout rather, feeling everything in me that had ever yearned for a woman yearning then, that I did. Before I could catch my breath, Rosh said, "Let's see some of the others." The girl ended her dance at once, made an obeisance, and left the room. "You may have more than one, you know, separately or together. We have some very large beds." The door opened again. "The Chatelaine Gracia." Though this girl seemed quite different, there was much about her that reminded me of the Chatelaine Barbia, who had come before her. Her hair was as white as the flakes that floated past the windows, making her youthful face seem younger still, and her dark complexion darker. She had, or seemed to have, larger breasts and more generous lips. Yet I felt it was almost possible that it was the same woman after all, that she had changed clothing, changed wings, dusked her face with cosmetics in the few seconds between the other's exit and her entrance. It was absurd, yet there was an element of truth in it, as in so many absurdities. There was something in the eyes of both women, in the expression of their mouths, their carriage, and the fluidity of their gestures, that was one. It recalled something I had seen elsewhere. I could not remember where, and yet it was new, and I felt somehow that the other thing, that which I had known earlier, was to be preferred. "That will do for me," Rosh said. "Now we must find something for my friend here." The dark girl, who had not danced as the other had, but had only stood, smiling very slightly, curtsying and turning in the center of the room, now permitted her smile to widen a trifle, went to Rosh, seated herself on the arm of his chair, and began whispering to him. As the door opened a third time, our host said, "The Chatelaine Thecla." It seemed really she, just as I had remembered her. How she had escaped, I could not guess. In the end, it was reason rather than observation that told me I was mistaken. What differences I could have detected with the two standing side by side, I cannot say, though certainly this woman was somewhat shorter. "It is she you wish, then," our host said. I could not recall speaking. Rosh stepped forward with a leather purse, announcing that he would pay for both of us. I watched the coins as he drew them out, waiting to see the gleam of a Krisos. It was not there. There were only a few Azami. The chatelaine Thecla touched my hand. The scent she wore was stronger than the faint perfume of the real Thecla. Still, it was the same scent, making me think of a rose burning.
"Come," she said.
I followed her. There was a corridor, dimly lit and not clean, then a narrow stair. I asked how many of the court were here, and she paused, looking down at me obliquely. Something there was in her face that might have been vanity satisfied, love, or that more obscure emotion we feel when what had been a contest becomes a performance.
"Tonight, very few. Because of the snow. I came in a sleigh with Gracia." I nodded. I thought I knew well enough that she had come only from one of the mean lanes about the house in which we were that night, and most likely on foot, with a shawl over her hair and the cold striking through old shoes. Yet what she said, I found more meaningful than reality. I could sense the sweating destriers leaping through the falling snow faster than any machine, the whistling wind, the young, beautiful, jaded women bundled inside in sable and lynx, dark against red velvet cushions.
"Aren't you coming?" She had already reached the top of the stair, nearly out of sight. Someone spoke to her, calling her my dearest sister. And when I had gone up a few steps more, I saw it was a woman very like the one who had been with Vodalus, she of the heart-shaped face and black hood. This woman paid no heed to me, and as soon as I gave her room to do so, hurried down the stair.
"You see now what you might have had if you'd only waited for one more to come out?"
A smile I had learned to know elsewhere lurked at one corner of my Paphian's mouth.
"I would have chosen you still." "Now that is truly amusing. Come on, come with me. You don't want to stand in this drafty hall forever." You kept a perfectly straight face, but your eyes rolled like a calf's. "She's pretty, isn't she?"
The woman who looked like Thecla opened the door, and we were in a tiny bedroom with an immense bed. A cold thurible hung from the ceiling by a silver gilt chain. A lampstand supporting a pink-tinted light stood in one corner. There was a tiny dressing table with a mirror, a narrow wardrobe, and hardly room enough for us to move.
"Would you like to undress me?"
I nodded and reached for her.
"Then I warn you, you must be careful of my clothes."
She turned away from me.
"This fastens at the back. Begin at the top at the back of my neck. If you get excited and tear something, he'll make you pay for it. Don't say you haven't been told."
My fingers found a tiny catch and loosed it.
"I would think, Chatelaine Thecla, that you would have plenty of clothes."
"I do. But do you think I want to return to the House Absolute in a torn gown? You must have others here."
"A few, but I can't keep much in this place. Someone takes things when I'm gone."
The stuff between my fingers, which had looked so bright and rich in the colonnaded blue room below, was thin and cheap. "No satins, I suppose," I said, as I unfastened the next catch. "No sables and no diamonds."
"Of course not."
I took a step away from her. It brought my back almost to the door. There was nothing of Thecla about her. All that had been a chance resemblance, some gestures, a similarity in dress. I was standing in a small, cold room, looking at the neck and bare shoulders of some poor young woman, whose parents, perhaps,
accepted their share of Rosh's meager silver gratefully, and pretended not to know where their daughter went at night.
"You are not the Chatelaine, Thekla," I said. "What am I doing here with you?"
There was surely more in my voice than I had intended. She turned to face me, the thin cloth of her gown sliding away from her breasts. I saw fear flicker across her face, as though directed by a mirror. She must have been in this situation before, and it must have turned out badly for her.
"I am Thekla," she said. "If you want me to be." I raised my hand, and she added quickly, "There are people here to protect me. All I have to do is scream. You may hit me once, but you won't hit me twice."
"No," I told her.
"Yes, there are. Three men."
"There is no one. The whole floor is empty and cold. Don't you think I've noticed how quiet it is? Rosh and his girl stayed below, and perhaps got a better room there because he paid. The woman we saw at the top of the stair was leaving, and wanted to speak to you first. Look."
I took her by the waist and lifted her into the air. "Scream. No one will come."
She was silent. I dropped her on the bed and after a moment sat down beside her.
"You are angry because I'm not Thekla. But I would have been Thekla for you. I will be, still."
She slipped the strange coat from my shoulders and let it fall.
"You're very strong."
"No, I'm not." I knew that some of the boys who were afraid of me were already stronger than I.
"Very strong. Aren't you strong enough to master reality? Even for a little while?"
"What do you mean?"
"Weak people believe what is forced on them. Strong people, what they wish to believe. Forcing that to be real. What is the autarch but a man who believes himself autarch and makes others believe by the strength of it?"
"You are not the Chatelaine Thekla," I told her.
"But don't you see? Neither is she. The Chatelaine Thekla, whom I doubt you've ever laid eyes on. No, I see I'm wrong. Have you been to the House Absolute?"
Her hands, small and warm, were on my own right hand, pressing. I shook my head.
"Sometimes clients say they have. I always find pleasure in hearing them."
"Have they been? Really?" She shrugged.
"I was saying that the Chatelaine Thekla is not the Chatelaine Thekla, not the Chatelaine Thekla of your mind, which is the only Chatelaine Thekla you care about." "Neither am I. What then is the difference between us?"
"None, I suppose." While I was undressing, I said, "Nevertheless, we all seek to discover what is real."
"Why is it?"
"Perhaps we are drawn to the Theocenter. That's what the Hierophants say. That only that is true." She kissed my thighs, knowing she had won.
"Are you really ready to find it? You must be clothed in favor, remember. Otherwise, you will be given over to the torturers. You wouldn't like that."
"No," I said, and took her head between my hands. Chapter 10. The Last Year. I think it was Master Gerloz's intention that I should be brought to that house often, so I would not become too much attracted to Thekla. In actuality, I permitted Rosh to pocket the money and never went there again. The pain had been too pleasurable,
the pleasure too painful, so that I feared that in time my mind would no longer be the thing I knew. Then, too, before Rosh and I had left the house, the white-haired man, catching my eye, had drawn from the bosom of his robe what I had at first thought was an icon, but soon saw to be a golden vial in the shape of a phallus. He had smiled, and because there had been nothing but friendship in his smile, it had frightened me. Some days passed before I could rid my thoughts of Thecla, of certain impressions belonging to the false Thecla, who had initiated me into the anacreontic divergence and fruitions of men and women. Possibly this had an effect opposite to that Master Gerlose intended, but I do not think so. I believe I was never less inclined to love the unfortunate woman than when I carried in my memory the recent impressions of having enjoyed her freely. It was as I saw it more and more clearly for the untruth it was, that I felt myself drawn to redress the fact, and drawn through her, though I was hardly conscious of it at the time, to the world of ancient knowledge and privilege she represented. The books I had carried to her became my university, she my oracle. I am not an educated man. From Master Palaemon I learned little more than to read, write, and cipher, with a few facts concerning the physical world and the requisites of our mystery. If educated men have sometimes thought me, if not their equal, at least one whose company did not shame them, that is owing solely to Thecla, the Thecla I remember, the Thecla who lives in me, and the four books. What we read together, and what we said of it to one another, I shall not tell. To recount the least of it would wear out this brief night. All that winter, while snow whitened the old yard, I came up from the oubliette as if from sleep, and started to see the tracks my feet left behind me, and my shadow on the snow. Thecla was sad that winter, yet she delighted in talking to me of the secrets of the past, of the conjectures formed of higher spheres, and of the arms and histories of heroes millennia dead. Spring came, and with it the purple-striped and white-dotted lilies of the necropolis. I carried them to her, and she said my beard had shot up like them, and I should be bluer of cheek than the run of common men, and the next day begged my pardon for it, saying I was that already. With the warm weather, and, I think, the blossoms I brought, her spirits lifted. When we traced the insignia of old houses, she talked to friends of her own station, and the marriages they had made, good and bad, and how such and such a one had exchanged her future for a ruined stronghold because she had seen it in a dream, and how another who had played at dolls with her when they were children was the mistress now of so many thousands of leagues.
And there must be a new autarch, and perhaps an autarchia sometime, you know, Severian. Things can go on as they have for a long while, but not forever. I know little of the court, Chatelaine. The less you know, the happier you will be.
She paused, white teeth nibbling her delicately curved lower lip.
When my mother was in labor, she had the servants carry her to the Vatik fountain, whose virtue is to reveal what is to come. It prophesied I should sit a throne. Thea has always envied me that. Still the autarch. Yes. It would be better if I didn't say too much. The autarch is not like other people. No matter how I may talk sometimes, on all of Earth there is no one like him. I know that. Then that is enough for you.
Look here. She held up the brown book.
Here it says, It was the thought of Thalileus the Great that the democracy, that means the people, desired to be ruled by some power superior to itself, and of Irieres the Sage, that the commonality would never permit one differing from themselves to hold high office. Notwithstanding this, each is called the perfect master. I did not see what she meant and said nothing. No one really knows what the Autarch will do. That's what it all comes down to. Or Father Anir either. When I first came to court, I was told, as a great secret, that it was Father Anir who really determined the policy of the Commonwealth. When I had been there 2 years, a man very highly placed, I can't even tell you his name, said it was the Autarch who ruled. Though to those in the House Absolute, it might seem that it was Father Anir. And last year, a woman whose judgment I trust more than any man's confided that it really made no difference, because they were both as unfathomable as the pelagic deeps, and if one decided things while the moon waxed and the other when the wind was in the east, no one could tell the difference anyway. I thought that was wise counsel. Until I realized she was only repeating something I had said to her myself half a year before. Thekla fell silent, reclining on the narrow bed, her dark hair spread in the pillow. "At least," I said, "you were right to have confidence in that woman. She had taken her opinions from a trustworthy source." As if she had not heard me, she murmured, "But it's all true, Severian. No one knows what they may do. I might be freed tomorrow. It's quite possible. They must know by now that I am here. Don't look at me like that. My friends will speak with Father Anir. Perhaps some may even mention me to the Autarch. You know why I was taken, don't you? Something about your sister. My half-sister Thea is with Vodalus. They say she is his paramour, and I think it extremely likely." I recalled the beautiful woman at the top of the stairs in the House Azure and said, "I think I saw your half-sister once. It was in the necropolis. There was an exultant with her, who carried a cane sword and was very handsome. He told me he was Vodalus. The woman had a heart-shaped face and a voice that made me think of doves. Was that she?"
"I suppose so. They want her to betray him to save me. And I know she won't. But when they discover that, why shouldn't they let me go?"
I spoke of something else until she laughed and said,
"You are so intellectual, Severian. When you're made a journeyman, you'll be the most cerebral torturer in history. A frightful thought."
"I was under the impression you enjoyed such discussions, Chatelaine."
"Only now, because I can't get out. Though it may come as a shock to you, when I was free, I seldom devoted time to metaphysics. I went dancing instead, and pursued the peccary with Pardine Limers.
The learning you admire was acquired when I was a girl, and sat with my tutor under the threat of the stick. We need not talk of such things, Chatelaine, if you would rather we not." She stood and thrust her face into the center of the bouquet I had picked for her.
"Flowers are better theology than folios, Severian. Is it beautiful in the necropolis where you got these?
You aren't bringing me the flowers from graves, are you? Cut flowers someone brought?"
"No, these were planted long ago. They come up every year."
At the slot in the door, Draught said, "Time to go." And I stood up.
"Do you think you may see her again? The Chatelaine Thea, my sister? I don't think so, Chatelaine. If you should, Severian, will you tell her about me? They may not have been able to communicate with her. There will be no treason in that. You'll be doing the Autark's work. I will, Chatelaine.
I was stepping through the doorway.
She won't betray Vodalus, I know, but there may be some compromise.
Drott closed the door and turned the key. It had not escaped me that Thecla had not asked how her sister and Vodalus had come to be in our ancient, and by such people as themselves, forgotten necropolis. The corridor, with its lines of metal doors and cold sweating walls, seemed dark after the lamp in the cell. Drott began to talk of an expedition he and Rosh had made to a lion pit across Guile. Over the sound of his voice, I heard Thecla calling faintly.
Remind her of the time we sewed Josepha's doll.
The lilies faded, as lilies do, and the dark death roses came into bloom. I cut them and carried them to Thecla, nigrescent purple, flecked with scarlet. She smiled and recited.
Here rose the graced, not rose the chaste, reposes. The scent that rises is no scent of roses. If their odor offends you, Chatelaine, not at all. It is very sweet. I was only quoting something my grandmother used to say.
The woman was infamous when she was a girl, or so she told me, and all the children chanted that rhyme when she died. Actually, I suspect it is much older and lost in time, like the beginnings of all the good and bad things.
Men are said to desire women, Severian. Why do they despise the women they obtain? I don't believe all do, Chatelaine. That beautiful rose gave herself and suffered such mockery for it that I know of it. Though her dreams long ago turned to dust with her smooth flesh. Come here and sit by me.
I did as I was told, and she slipped her hand under the frayed bottom of my shirt and drew it over my head. I protested, but found myself unable to resist.
What are you ashamed of?
You who have no breasts to hide.
I've never seen such white skin coupled with dark hair. Do you think my own skin white?
Very white, Chatelaine.
So do others.
But it is done next to yours.
You must flee the sun when you're a torturer, Severian. You'll burn terribly.
Her hair, which she often let fall free, today was bound about her head in a dark aureole. She had never more closely resembled her half-sister Thea, and I felt such desire for her that I seemed to be spilling my blood upon the floor, growing weaker and fainter with each contraction of my heart.
Why are you pounding on my door?
Her smile told me she knew. I must go.
You'd better put your shirt back on before you leave.
You wouldn't want your friend to see you like that. That night, though I knew it was in vain, I went to the necropolis and spent several watches in wandering among the silent houses of the dead. The next night I returned, and the next. But on the fourth, Rosh took me into the city, and in a drinking den I heard someone who seemed to know say that Vodalus was far to the north, hiding among the frost-pinched forests and raiding Kafilas. Days passed. Thecla was certain now, since she had been held in safety so long, that she would never be put to torment, and had Drott bring her materials for writing and drawing, with which she planned a villa she meant to build on the southern shore of Lake Diaturna, which is said to be the most remote part of the Commonwealth, as well as the most beautiful. I took parties of apprentices to swim, thinking that to be my duty, though I could never dive in deep water without fear. Then, suddenly as it seemed, the weather was too cold for swimming. One morning there was sparkling frost on the worn flagstones of the old yard,
and fresh pork appeared in our plates at dinner, a sure sign that the cold had reached the hills below the city. Master Gerloes and Master Palaemon summoned me. Master Gerloes said, "From several quarters we have had good reports of you, Severian. And now your apprenticeship is nearly served." Nearly whispering, Master Palaemon added, "Your boyhood is behind you, your manhood ahead of you." There was affection in his voice. "Just so," Master Gerloes continued. "The feast of our patroness draws near. I suppose you have given thought to it." I nodded. "Ito will be captain after me." "And you?" I did not understand what was meant. Master Palaemon, seeing that, asked gently, "What will you be, Severian? A torturer? You may leave the guild, you know, if you prefer." I told him firmly, and as though I were slightly shocked by the suggestion, that I had never considered it. It was a lie. I had known, as all the apprentices knew, that one was not firmly and finally a member of the guild until one consented as an adult to the connection. Furthermore, though I loved the guild, I hated it too. Not because of the pain it inflicted on clients who must sometimes have been innocent, and who must often have been punished beyond anything that could be justified by their offenses, but because it seemed to me inefficient and ineffectual, serving a power that was not only ineffectual but remote. I do not know how better to express my feelings about it than by saying that I hated it for starving and humiliating me, and loved it because it was my home. Hated and loved it because it was the exemplar of old things. Because it was weak, and because it seemed indestructible. Naturally, I expressed none of this to Master Palaemon, though I might have if Master Gerloes had not been present. Still, it seemed incredible that my profession of loyalty made in rags could be taken seriously, yet it was. "Whether you have considered leaving us or not," Master Palaemon told me, "it is an option open to you. Many would say that only a fool would serve out the hard years of apprenticeship and refuse to become a journeyman of his guild when his apprenticeship was passed, but you may do so if you wish."
"Where would I go?"
That, though I could not tell them so, was the real reason I was staying. I knew that a vast world lay outside the walls of the citadel, indeed outside the walls of our tower. But I could not imagine that I could ever have any place in it. Faced with a choice between slavery and the emptiness of freedom, I added, "I have been reared in our guild," for fear they would answer my question.
"Yes," Master Gerloes said in his most formal manner. "But you are no torturer yet. You have not put on Phylogen."
Master Palaemon's hand, dry and wrinkled as a mummy's, groped until it found mine. "Among the initiates of religion, it is said, you are an apopt always. The reference is not only to knowledge, but to their chrism, whose mark, being invisible, is ineradicable. You know our chrism." I nodded again. "Less even than theirs, can it be washed away? Should you leave now, men will only say he was nurtured by the torturers. But when you have been anointed, they will say he is a torturer. You may follow the plow or the drum, but still you will hear, he is a torturer. Do you understand that?"
"I wish to hear nothing else."
That as well, Master Grillo said, and suddenly they both smiled. Master Palaemon showing his few old crooked teeth, and Master Grillo's his square yellow ones, like the teeth of a dead nag.
Then it is time that we explain to you the final secret.
I can hear the emphasis his voice gave the words even as I write.
For it would be well for you to think upon it before the ceremony.
Then he and Master Palaemon expounded to me that secret which lies at the heart of the guild and is the more sacred because no liturgy celebrates it, and it lies naked in the lap of the Pan Creator. And they swore me never to reveal it, save, as they did, to one about to enter upon the mysteries of the guild. I have since broken that oath, as I have many others. Chapter 11 The Feast. The day of our patroness falls in the fading of winter. Then do we make merry. The journeymen perform the sword dance in procession, leaping and fantastic. The masters light the ruined chapel in the grand court with 1,000 perfumed candles, and we ready our feast. In the guild, the annual observance is counted as lofty, in which a journeyman is elevated to mastership, lesser, in which one apprentice at least is created journeyman, or least, in which no elevation takes place. Since no journeyman rose to mastership in the year in which I was made a journeyman, which is not to be wondered at, since such occasions are rarer than the decades, the ceremony of my masking was a lesser feast. Even so, weeks were spent in preparation. I have heard it said that no less than 135 guilds have members laboring within the citadel walls. Of these, some, as we have seen among the curators, are too few to keep their patrons' feast in the chapel, but must join their brothers in the city. Those more numerous celebrate with such pomp as they may to raise the esteem in which they are held. Of this kind are the soldiers upon Hadrian's Day, the matroses on Barbara's, the witches on Mag's, and many others. By pageantry and wonders, and freely given food and drink, they seek to have as many as may be from outside their guilds attend their ceremonies. Not so is it among the torturers. No one from without the guild has dined with us at Holy Catherine's feast for more than 300 years, when a lieutenant of the guard, so it is said, dared to come for a wager. There are many idle tales of what befell him, as that we made him seat himself at our table upon a chair of glowing iron. None of them are true. By the lore of our guild, he was made welcome and well-feasted. But because we did not, over our meat and Catherine cake, talk of the pain we had inflicted, or devise new modes of torment, or curse those whose flesh we had torn for dying too soon, he grew ever more anxious, imagining that we sought to lull his fears so we might entrap him subsequently. Thus thinking, he ate little and drank much, and, returning to his own quarters, fell and struck his head in such a way that he evermore upon occasion lost his wits and suffered great pain. In time he put the muzzle of his own weapon into his mouth, but it was none of our doing. None but torturers, then, come to the chapel on Holy Catherine's Day. Yet each year, knowing we are watched from high windows, we prepare, as do all the rest, and more grandly. Outside the chapel, our wines burn like gems in the light of 100 flambeaus. Our beeves steam and wallow in ponds of gravy, rolling baked lemon eyes. Capybaras and agoutis, posed in the stances of life, and bearing fur in which toasted coconut mingles with their own flayed skin, clamber on logs of ham, and scale boulders of new baked bread. Our masters,
of whom, when I was made journeyman, there were only two, arrive in sedan chairs, whose curtains are woven of blossoms, and tread carpets patterned of colored sands, carpets telling of the traditions of the guild, and laid grain by grain by the journeymen in days of toil, and destroyed at once by the feet of the masters. Within the chapel wait a great spiked wheel, a maid, and a sword. That wheel I knew well, for as an apprentice I had several times assisted in setting it up and taking it down. It was stored in the topmost part of the tower, just under the gun room, when it was not in use. The sword, though it seemed a true headsman's blade from a pace or two away, was no more than a wooden baton, provided with an old hilt and brightened with tinsel. Of the maid I can tell you nothing. When I was very young, I did not even wonder about her. Those are the earliest feasts I can remember. When I was a little older, and Gildas, who was long since a journeyman at the time of which I write, was captain of apprentices, I thought her perhaps one of the witches. When I grew a year older, I knew such disrespect would not be tolerated. Perhaps she was a servant from some remote part of the citadel. Perhaps she was a resident of the city, who for gain, or because of some old connection with our guild, consented to play the part. I do not know. I only know that each feast found her in her place, and so far as I could judge, unchanged. She was tall and slender, though not so tall nor so slender as Thecla, dark of complexion, dark of eye, raven of hair. Hers was such a face as I have never seen elsewhere, like a pool of pure water found in the midst of a wood. She stood between the wheel and the sword, while Master Palaemon, as the older of our masters, told us of the founding of the guild, and of our precursors in the years before the ice came. This part was different each year, as his scholarship decided. Silent she stood too, while we sang the fearful song, the hymn of the guild, which apprentices must get by heart, but which is sung only on that one day of the year. Silent she stood too, while we knelt among the broken pews and prayed. Then Master Gerloes and Master Palaemon, aided by several of the older journeymen, began her legend. Sometimes one spoke alone, sometimes all chanted together, sometimes two spoke to different effect, while the others played flutes they had carved of thigh bones, or the three-stringed rebeck that shrieks like a man. When they reached that part of the narration at which our patroness is condemned by Maxentius, four masked journeymen rushed out to seize her. So silent and serene before, she resisted now, struggled and cried out. But as they bore her toward it, the wheel appeared to blur and change. In the light of the candles, it seemed at first that serpents, green pythons with jeweled heads of scarlet and citrine and white, writhed from it. Then it was seen that these were flowers, roses in the bud. When the maid was but a step away, they bloomed. They were of paper, concealed, as I well knew, within the segments of the wheel. Feigning fear, the journeyman drew back. But the narrators, Gerloes, Palaemon, and the others, speaking together as Maxentius, urged them on. Then I, still unmasked, and in the dress of an apprentice, stepped forward and said, "Resistance avails nothing. You are to be broken on the wheel, but we would do you no further indignity." The maid gave no answer but reached out and touched the wheel, which at once fell to pieces, collapsing with a clatter to the floor, all its roses gone. "Behead her," demanded Maxentius, and I took up the sword. It was very heavy. She knelt before me. "You are a counselor of omniscience," I said. "Though I must slay you, I beg you spare my life." For the first time the maid spoke, saying,
Strike and fear not. I lifted the sword. I remember that for a moment I feared it would overbalance me. When I think back on that time,